Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to www.rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Comedian Chris Rock once said in an interview, if poor people knew how rich rich people are, there would be riots in the streets. Which brings up a good question. Most people do understand that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, so why aren't there riots in the streets? Perhaps it has to do with how we perceive the world around us and how well that perception matches the reality. Nick Fitz is a graduate student at the National Core for Neuroethics at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of a recent article on economic inequality, which is available on the web at scientificamerican.com. And Nick Fitz spoke recently with Red Eye Collective member Jim Menge in the studio.
Your studies out at UBC are mostly related to health. How did you become interested in economic inequality in particular?
That's right. I'm a graduate student at the National Core for Neuroethics at UBC. My primary advisor is Peter Reiner. And we do, in general, look at attitudes and beliefs, stigma, discrimination, biases, this sort of thing, towards health issues. That is definitely the case. So I've been following this general sort of work on attitudes for a while, and this, of course, fits into that, and been always quite interested when a study had set up sort of what people's ideal situation was, what they thought the reality was, and then what the reality actually is. And so when I saw these three papers, I think 2015 was the last one, earlier this year, all published in this journal called Perspectives on Psychological Science, then I became quite interested in this specific topic. And it's something I've also been following for a while. It's probably worth noting that I'm originally from Washington, D.C. I've been here for 3 years, but I've followed economic inequality relatively closely since then.
You mentioned that there were three particular articles that you reviewed in this article in Scientific American. Can you go into a little more detail about what those three specific articles were about?
Sure. The first one, and again, they all were published in the same journal. The first one came out in 2011, and it was about perceptions of wealth inequality. The really interesting finding there was that they asked Americans to guess sort of how a pie was divided. So evenly would be 5 slices each or 20% each. And they said, well, how do you think wealth in America is divided? Most people thought that the top, say, 20% had around 30%. They knew that it wasn't equal, but they thought it was relatively equal. They thought, say, the bottom 40% had around 10 or 11% of the wealth. Of course, the reality is quite different. The top 20%, so the biggest slice, actually has more than 80% of the wealth. And the bottom 40%, so the bottom 40% of all Americans have 0.3%. And the sort of take home of this was that ideally, in an American's ideal world, whether they were rich or poor, Republican or Democrat, they all wanted a more equal distribution. And this was followed up in 2014 with income inequality, which is something I think a bit easier for people to grasp. And the long and the short answer there was that they asked people what they thought the reality was between a CEO and an average paid worker, so not even the lowest paid worker, but a CEO and the average paid worker at a company. People guessed that it was about 30 to 1, so the CEO made 30 times, roughly, they thought, than the average paid worker. Ideally, they would have liked the ratio to be 7 to 1, and the reality, as it turns out, is 354 to 1. Again, they showed that all of these trends were the same across all demographic groups, this sort of thing, Republicans, Democrats, rich, poor. And the last study, which I think the researchers conducted to try to sort out maybe why this was the case, looked at Americans' perceptions of social mobility. So how likely it was that if you start, say, in the bottom 20%, that you end up later in life, that you move up. and or vice versa, wherever you start high in the sort of economic distribution and you end up lower. And people thought, of course, that it was much easier to move up than it was to move down, which doesn't make a lot of sense, because if there are people moving up, then people need to move down. But they were much more likely to think that it was easier to move up, and much more likely than it is, actually. So while the trends here were similar to the first two studies, what was interesting here is that people actually that made less money, so people lower on the sort of economic distribution, thought that it was easier to move up. So that was the difference there. And so all three studies together paint this sort of quite interesting picture where we think it's much more equal than it actually is, and we wish it was even more equal than we think it is.
Now, why do you think that there was such a large difference between the perception and the reality?
I think a lot of it, that's a good question. I think a lot of it is this sort of story that we, or this myth that we've told ourselves in America. Part of it has to do with things like the American dream and the ability to sort of pull oneself up by one's bootstraps. But we really want to believe in America sort of as this land of opportunity where somebody can come and really sort of make it big. And there are those stories, of course, and we love those. But it's just not very realistic, actually. As it turns out, the sort of bottom 20% in America is probably worse off than any other bottom 20% in any other developed world. And we do have the most social inequality of the developed world today by a wide margin. So it's sort of part of the American ethos or part of our culture, certainly, to believe in this ability to move up. And it's a bit sad that it's actually just, it doesn't really map the reality at all.
And one of the more interesting things you wrote in your article is about how people in the U.S. Think wealth should be distributed. I know you mentioned it before, but can you go into a little more detail about that?
Sure. In every instance, so both for wealth inequality and income inequality, the researchers asked in this situation, so what would be your ideal situation? You know, this is... when they mentioned this in their discussion, they mentioned this idea just from the philosopher John Rawls, a political philosopher, about the veil of ignorance. And the question really is, so if you were to randomly be placed into a society, how would you like then that society to be broken up? And so they were interested in this concept, and they asked people what their ideal conditions were. And across the board, people wanted less income inequality and less wealth inequality, even than they thought the reality was. And so it really shows that we don't really want to live this way, whether even rich Republicans, who are sort of stereotypically the most fiscally conservative, wish that it was more equal. Now, we certainly disagree on how to get there, but what we don't disagree on is that we'd all like it to be better.
Now, it certainly seems that everyone, at least at some level, they understand that there is a problem. Why do you suppose there aren't more protests or rioting in the streets?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I think it's very hard for people to grasp just how bad it is. And so a thing that always sort of comes that really reminded me of this, or a sort of a statistic that I do bring up in the article, is that the Walton family, so the family that owns Walmart, had eight kids, and those eight kids inherited a bunch of money. And as a group of eight, they have more wealth than the bottom 42% of Americans combined. So, you know, tens of millions of Americans have less wealth than these eight people. And it's somewhat, it's surprising in many ways, because we're a land of, America's built on this idea of really sort of hard work. But I think it's just hard for people to grasp how bad it is. You know, it's one thing to see a number or to hear about rising inequality, and another to really get a sense of what it's like. And I think a big part of the reason is also just that we don't see it on the street. So I know now there's never been this amount of inequality without there being a major revolution throughout much of human history. And part of it is that we just don't see it. It's not as obvious. It's hidden away. And people of that level, really, it's a different world that people live in. So it's much less visible, I think.
Another one of the really interesting parts of the article you wrote in Scientific American was about the origin and the use of the term meritocracy. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Sure. So originally, the person who came up with this concept of a meritocracy wrote it as part of an essay that was, for the most part, satirical. So Michael Young first used the term in 1958 in that essay, The Rise of the Meritocracy, and it was meant to sort of criticize or really highlight a society that is ruled by what he called the talent elite. So it's not that he disagreed with the notion of sort of people receiving jobs based on their merit or based on whether they deserved it or not. It's just that he said, you know, when we define merit or when we define what you have to do to deserve to be in this social class in a certain way, we really exclude a group of other people. And the book was meant to sort of raise concerns at that point in the mid to late 20th century. And he really meant it as something that he really meant it not as a positive term. And so then he wrote an essay, I think, in 2001 in The Guardian asking that we not use this anymore.
So it's become more of a term of like a status term rather than anything to do with actual talent or anything like that.
Right.
It's just a way of separating one group of people from another group of people.
Correct. We've used this word now, meritocracy, to defend this practice of deciding that a group with certain qualifications is worthy of this much money, say for the time, as opposed to another. And in many ways, we've sort of become this dystopia that he imagined.
I know I've asked this question already in another forum, but why do you think so many people, they're willing to put up with such gross levels of inequality? Is it solely because they don't perceive the inequality that exists in Canada and the United States, well, pretty well every developed world?
Right.
Or is there more to it than that, do you think?
Yeah, I think part of it also is that we all think, and this is really what this 2015 study was getting at, that we all think that we're going to be rich, essentially. We all think we can move up. We think it's much more likely that we can move up than it is that people move down. And so when you have this sort of unbridled optimism that really comes as a part of this North American ethos, you get a group of people who, as in the last study, people even that were lower or that made less money thought it was more likely that they were able to move up. You know, you have a group of people thinking that this is very realistic, and so nobody wants to sort of change the tax structure or change the sort of incentives. Even though a good example of this is what's often called the death tax in America, but it's an estate tax, and it only affects really something like 0.3% of the population. You have to make, I think it's over 10 million to have your estate be taxed, but many, many Americans are opposed to this because they think, well, I might make this amount of money, or it may affect me. And this optimism, I think, ends up in this situation to be quite damaging.
Now, I know you come from Washington, D.C., where I expect the income inequality is probably even more stark than it is here in Vancouver. Just through your own experience and your thoughts about after studying these papers, can you see any way to move forward to help solve this problem?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is funny, both D.C. and Vancouver are very good examples of places where there's deep, deep economic inequality. And it's growing up there and then having lived here for a few years, it's very sort of obvious to many people, I think. But it's a hard thing to change. I think even when people's attitudes change, and we're seeing more sort of awareness of this, and even with movements like Occupy, you know, regardless of how much they've done, they've certainly raised awareness. We have the rhetoric of the 1%. And so I think that's been a positive, certainly a positive move forward. But probably the more important change will come, as it often does, with policy. And that will depend on how much we care about changing this issue and the sorts of policies that are put forward. I know Piketty and a number of people have talked about ways to change the situation. I think some of it can be done with taxes. Certainly taxes on capital gains. There's a history of us deciding how to distribute the resources that we have as a society, and some of it takes just an agreement on a political level and on a policy level to make some changes. I mean, the tax bracket, even the sort of highest level of tax in America, is not anywhere close to the way that people that make that much money get taxed in Europe. Canada is somewhere in the middle. But I think that there are a number of sort of small to big policy changes that we can make that really will quickly distribute the wealth in a way that we all would like it to be distributed. I mean, that's I think the take home is that everybody would like this to change.
And that was Nick Fitz in conversation with Red Eye Collective member James Menge. Nick Fitz is a graduate student at the National Core for Euroethics at UBC. His recent article, Economic Inequality, It's Far Worse Than You Think, is available on the web at scientificamerican.com.